weapons can we respond to the present situation? From this perspective, it is hard not to see the prolongation of this agony delivered upon a particular people, the Palestinians, and its broadcasting of their most vulnerable moments as some kind of further testing ground of the very category of the human and humans. And it also brings into sharp relief just how limited political powers are, even in ostensibly representative democracies. The significance of South Africa bringing the charge of genocide against the child killer regime of Israel to the International Court of Justice, along with the ICJ's initial findings, cannot be underestimated, but it remains only a tool that we must learn how to use in order to expand the grounds upon which we think and act in the world. As we watch the core institutions in Western societies rot and disintegrate from within due to an inability to name what is happening in Gaza and the world, positions once deemed principled ring more than hollow. As mothers in Gaza can barely give birth or feed their babies, as fathers cannot protect their children, as doctors cannot heal, and as many cannot even retrieve the bodies of their loved ones for burial, we can only conclude that this poisonous cruelty is aimed at the very idea of being a child, a mother, a father, a healer, a mourner. We are up against a regime that has taken direct aim at humanity. With every minute that passes, new lessons in cowardice and cruelty are given by the Israelis and their US and Western enablers. At the same time, we must stand in humble awe of the resistance and humanity shown by the people of Gaza. But in continuing to expose the Zionist regime's genocide against Palestinians, we must ask more of ourselves. We must find ever more useful ways to resist and stay human in pursuit of a just political solution to one of the world's most exposed and festering wounds whose time for healing has long been evident.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, virtues make you happy and corruption makes you sad. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an honor to be here. Dear friends, we're talking about Islamic lifestyle. Now, one of the things, and what's interesting is whether it's an Islamic lifestyle or it's not an Islamic lifestyle, one of the fundamental pillars or one of the fundamental foundations and one of the realities of this universe is that moral virtues will make you happy and moral corruption will make you sad. Now, one of the things that we learn throughout all of the religions that have been sent forth, which in reality is one pure message that the Almighty Allah has sent for the guidance and the perfection of humanity, that one message which, because of human beings, has become manifested in different religions, but the final, complete, comprehensive message is Islam. In this message, one of the fundamental things is that moral virtues, righteousness, honor, nobility, all of these things will gain and give you happiness. And on the other hand, moral corruptions, evil, moral vices, all of these things will make you sad. This is something which is set in stone. You can waste your whole life trying to experiment it by going down the path of moral vices to see will it make you sad or not. You can waste your life doing that, or you can just take the word of the Almighty Allah and the messengers and the imams, peace and blessings upon them, who have already told us this. And in reality, if we were to experience this, and we probably have experienced this in our life, we will also get to the conclusion and the end result that truly moral virtues will make you happy and moral vices will make you sad. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how moral virtues will make you happy and how moral vices will make you sad. Now, this is something, as we had left off the last segment, where we said that this is something that we can experience. When we do a good deed, when we help a neighbor, when we help somebody who's being oppressed, when we do good deeds, good actions, when we pray, when we fast, when we go to Hajj, when we go on Ziyarat pilgrimage, right? When we do good deeds and we represent moral virtues, it does make us happy. It brings us a sense of peace, relaxation, happiness, tranquility, serenity. And this is something that everybody, it feels good to do something good. But on the other hand, innately, when it comes to moral vices, they make us sad. And what's really interesting is that even if we ourselves don't involve ourselves in moral vices, even if we look at somebody else or we witness moral vices, even that makes us feel bad, and it makes us feel sad and forlorn. And it's a reality, right? Because the essence of vice, the essence of evil, the essence of falsehood is dark, and it makes you feel sad. But on the other hand, the essence of good, the essence of truth, the essence of light, it makes you feel good. It has light within it. It brings you out of darkness into guidance. And so most surely a fundamental rule to live by when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle: moral virtues will make us happy and moral vices will make us sad.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions there. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917, when mustard gas is used for the first time, and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of a present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
You The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, over 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. Find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. we decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible. And we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded, and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage, because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms. But some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thioglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater, to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases, and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you load in there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist fishing vessels that have caught chemical contaminations. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels of mustard gas and Lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm. And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area. And the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
Iqra. بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
قد عودك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. السلام عليكم. Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you so much for joining us. Today, here we are with Brother Fawad Haider, and I'm really happy to say hello to him. Fawad, salam, how are you?
Salam, sir. I'm fine. How about you?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us today. Inshallah, today we'll talk about Surah An-Nisa, verse 14 on page 79. Fawad, ready to listen first to the recitation?
Yes.
All right.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ومن يعص الله ورسوله ويتعد حدوده يدخله نارا خالدا فيها وله عذاب مهين.
That was a nice recitation, mashallah. Brothers and sisters, stay with IRIB English Radio every day, the same time, inshallah. We'll have a Quranic session on practical tajweed rules and practicing the recitation of the Quranic Kareem, inshallah. And also, we all have a short explanation. So, in this ayah, Fawad, let's talk about this ayah, like just a bit, explain it, okay? From the Tafasir books. Then, inshallah, for the details and more explanations, first and foremost, I want Fawad and our brothers and sisters who are listening to IRIB English Radio right now, I want you, inshallah, to refer to the Tafasir books and read more. So, Fawad, Allah Almighty says in Ayah 14 of Surah An-Nisa, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ وَمَنْ يَعْصِ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ وَيَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَهُ يُدْخِلْهُ نَارًا خَالِدًا فِيهَا وَلَهُ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ. Very beautiful ayah, and this is a warning for us, okay? For anybody who believes in God, anybody who believes in Islamic rulings, okay? Ahkam, for what? Alright? So this is a warning. In the previous ayah, look. Tilka hududullah. Allah Almighty said, Tilka hududullah. These are the Allah Almighty's rulings, okay? وَمَن يُطِعِ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ. In the previous ayah, Allah Almighty says what? وَمَن يُطِعِ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ. The one who obeys. But in this ayah, Allah Almighty says what? But whoever disobeys Allah and His apostle. So obedience and disobedience. These two are compared in these two verses. So in the previous verse, we talked about this, that whoever obeys Allah Almighty and His apostle, what will happen to them? Yudkhilhu Jannat. Allah Almighty will let them enter the Jannah. Okay? And in this ayah, Allah Almighty says, whoever disobeys Allah and His apostle, وَيَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَهُ, and transgresses the bounds set by Allah Almighty and crosses the red lines, okay? The red lines. So what happens? In the previous ayah, those who are obeying, يُدْخِلْهُ jannat. In this ayah, those who disobey, يُدْخِلْهُ
النار.
النار. يُدْخِلْهُ نَارًا خَالِدًا فِيهَا. He shall make him enter a fire to remain in it forever. وَلَهُ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ. And there will be humiliating punishment for him. So what happens? Why is this? Look, there is like a list of instructions. You got a goal, a purpose, okay? Like the previous example, I want to give you the same example here. A muscular body. You want to get ready for example, a competition, okay? So this is like, for example, what do you say? That is like a competition, okay, that needs you to be so muscular, okay? Bodybuilding show, okay? So here, you got to get ready. You got what? For example, 1 year time to get ready for that competition, okay? Bodybuilding competition, okay? So here, you got to get ready. Go and work out. You go to a gym, you go to a trainer, you ask him, sir, I need to get ready for this competition. So, can you please give me some kind of instructions so I can get ready? So, the coach, okay, or the trainer gives you like a list of instructions and do's and don'ts. Yes, that you have to do these things. You have to avoid these things. So, you want to get that to that like muscular body, that body shape, yeah, you want to have. So, there are two cases. You go, follow the instructions, you get to the goal. So, what happens? The result?
You win the competition.
Gotcha. The result is that you win. What about you kind of become, you show laziness. You don't make your efforts to follow all the instructions like completely and correctly. What happens to you? The date of the competition arrives. Okay? This is, for example, the competition day. What happens to you? How do you feel?
Ashamed.
Ashamed. Why? Why I didn't do? You will like what? You burn from inside. Why? Why? I had time. I had the instructions. I had everything. I just became lazy. That's what happens exactly to a person who has the instructions, Islamic instructions, but he does not follow. So in the Day of Judgment, he will be ashamed of himself that he sees everybody is having like a happy life. They are going to Jannah, and he is not going to Jannah. Of course, he will regret that day. That's the message. Inshallah, go to the Fasir books, okay? And learn about the Islamic rulings more and more, about the explanation more and more.
قرآني في قلبي دوما يغمرني من فيض ضياء آيات
IRIB English Radio, in cooperation with Xavier International Schools, presents Let's Recite the Quran.
So, Fawad, that's it from the explanation. That was a nice message, yes? Fawad, now it's time for what?
Tajweed rules.
Brothers and sisters, thank you so much for being with us up to now. Now it's time to mention some Tajweed rules and practice the recitation of this ayah. Fawad, what do you think the first important point here in this ayah should be like about Tajweed? It should be?
Pronunciations
of the letter. So, would you please help us with the letters that we really must focus on and pay attention to them to pronounce them correctly, and they might be a bit difficult.
So the first one is wa.
Wa, all right. So wa, we don't have va in Arabic. That's a nice point. Wa, like W, you say what? When? You don't say when. That V sound we have in English, like very. All right? But we don't have it in Arabic. So we have wa sound. All right, next one.
Ayn.
Ayn doesn't exist in English, so we have it in Arabic. So all you need to do is like pronounce it with a throaty sound. Pull some air back, okay? Very easy. Go on.
Then sod.
Sod. It has like a whistling sound. Not too much. No. It's a bit different from the scene. Okay, next one.
Ha.
Ha. Nice one. Ha, the soft one. It's the same as H sound in English. Next.
Ha.
Ha, the throaty one. Nice one. Ha and ha. Okay, next one. Kha, right? Khalidan fiha. Kha.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a heavy sound. And the last one.
Dhal.
Dhal, adhab. So these letters are important. They matter really much, okay? And you should pay attention to them. Okay, the Tajweed rules now, the recitation. One thing for what, I think we have many rules, and I'm sure many rules, four rules, yes? For Tanween and Noon Sakin. So here we got a Tanween, Waman. Then we have the letter Ya. Can you explain about the Tanween and Noon Sakin? The rules?
So when Tanween or Noon comes,
okay,
Noon Sakin.
All right.
The next letter
matters
after the word.
Okay.
So it should be in the group of four basic rules.
Okay. Which rules?
Idgham. Idhar, Ikhfa,
and Iqlab. So these four rules. Idgham, Ikhfa, Idhar, and Iqlab. So it means you say that we should apply one of these rules right after the
Nun Sakin and Tanween.
So that letter that comes after the Nun Sakin or Tanween, it matters. It should match one of these four letters, so, four groups, yes?
Four groups of letters.
Uh-huh. So Ya, like in which group?
It's in group of the Yarmalun letters, which consists the rule...
Idgham. So what does it mean? Idgham?
So it basically means merging.
Oh, merging
merge,
this way.
Yeah, to noon, and you make a double noon sound.
All right,
like more
double yeah sound. You mean yes?
Yes, double yeah,
yeah. Double yeah sound. So this way, waman is changed to wamay, right? Wamay ya'sillaha wa rasulahu. So that's all. وَيَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَهُ. Do you see the baby wa? What does it say?
You should stretch it.
Extend the sound or stretch it, yeah?
Yeah.
All right, good. So for two counts. وَيَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَهُ يُدْخِلْهُ. For the dalif, it appears sakin.
Yes.
Do we have a rule?
Yeah, there are five letters.
All right, which letters?
Which, if they're sakin.
All right.
قُطْبَجَتْ letters.
قُطْبَجَتْ قَاف, طَا, بَا, جِيم, and دَال. So, brothers
so
and sisters,
if these letters are sakin,
mm-hmm.
We pronounce a bouncing or an echoing sound for them, like yud.
Yudkhilhu, mashallah. Thank you. Yudkhilhu. So, if you want to recite it beautifully, you have to follow these rules, yes? An echoing sound produced with the dal. Yudkhilhu. Right. Now, ran khalidan. We got a tanween. After the tanween, we have kha.
So, it's izhar. No
izhar. It means what?
No change.
No changes. Good, good. Now, ran khalidan. Kha. It's a heavy letter.
Yes.
Pronouncing with a heavy sound, yes?
Yes.
Khalidan. Khalidan. Okay, khalidan has a tanween.
Then
fa. Fa matches the
rest of the letters.
And we should
hide the
hide
sound.
Hide the sound. Khalidan fiha wa lahu azabun muhin. Tanween plus meme.
Idgham.
Idgham. Merge the sound. Azabun muhin. So, I'll recite. Let's practice this together. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, practice with us. وَمَن يَعْصِ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ وَيَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَهُ وَمَن يَعْصِ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ وَيَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَهُ وَيَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَهُ يُدْخِلْهُ نَارًا خَالِدًا فِيهَا وَيَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَهُ يُدْخِلْهُ نَارًا خَالِدًا فِيهَا وَلَهُ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ وَلَهُ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ. أحسنتم ما شاء الله. Thank you so much. Brothers and sisters, we hope inshallah you have learned this and this session was beneficial for you. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks Fawad for being with us and practicing with us today. Inshallah, next session will continue with Surah An-Nisa. Thanks to Arab English Radio. Thank you so much, brothers and sisters, for being with us. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammadi wa alihi al-tahirin. Allahumma صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن و الفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
Less than 2 weeks after launching its genocide on the Gaza Strip, the Israeli military committed one of the most heinous atrocities in modern history. Back on October 18th, a huge blast rocked the Al-Ahli hospital compound in Gaza, which was packed with thousands of Palestinians seeking shelter from the Israeli strikes. According to Palestinian health officials, more than 470 people were killed in that incident. Most of the victims were defenseless civilians who had taken shelter at the hospital and its surrounding areas. At the time, they had no idea that the Israeli regime might target hospitals. Hospitals and clinics have special protections under international law. And the deliberate targeting of these facilities is a clear violation of these principles. As usual, the Israeli army first denied that it was behind the attack. Later, the regime and its Western allies, including the United States and Canada, claimed that the explosion was caused by an errant rocket fired by the armed group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. However, independent investigations by various media sources have debunked this propaganda. The New York Times conducted a thorough analysis of video footage from the night of October 17th, which clearly showed that the missile seen in the video, supposedly fired by Palestinian fighters, did not cause the explosion at the hospital. Instead, it detonated in the sky, approximately 2 miles away. It was, in fact, a missile fired by the Israeli military that caused a devastating explosion.
According to all feeds and videos analyzed, this rocket was intercepted and was the last one launched from Gaza before the bombing of the hospital. 5 seconds after that interception, an explosion in Gaza can be seen, followed 2 seconds later by a much larger explosion. This is the strike that hit Al-Ahli Arab Hospital. As a result, Al Jazeera digital investigations team found no grounds to the Israeli army claim that the strike on the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza was caused by a failed rocket launch.
But Al-Ahli Hospital was not the last hospital targeted by the Israeli military during its onslaught in Gaza. According to a report by Human Rights Watch in 2023, the Israeli military has repeatedly and unlawfully attacked medical facilities, personnel, and transport, further destroying Gaza's healthcare system. The report says that these attacks should be investigated as war crimes, as they violated international humanitarian law.
Because every society has the right to have a healthcare system, and that's why the healthcare system is protected by the Geneva Convention. And the fourth Geneva Convention is utterly clear, has always been. And that's why these attacks on healthcare that are so well documented and the most extreme, the most brutal examples are the situations like we have in Nasser Medical Complex now, where they're shooting and killing staff and patients inside. and the situation we had in the West Bank, where they again dressed up like doctors, fake doctors, and relatives coming, and hid their weapons and went into this room and shot and killed this patient who was actually immobilized, this Palestinian young man, and his two companions. Killed him, executed him and his two companions under the disguise of being medical personnel. The reason why this is so serious and why it is not stopped is so serious is that it threatens the immunity of the healthcare system and the safe network, the safety network that the healthcare system provides to people around the world.
On January 31st, an undercover Israeli death squad posing as Palestinians brazenly infiltrated a hospital in the occupied West Bank, resulting in the assassination of three Palestinians, one of whom was a partially paralyzed patient. Surveillance footage captured the alarming scene as approximately a dozen Israeli special forces raided Ibn Sina Hospital in the northern city of Jenin. Disguised as Palestinian medical personnel and civilian women, they brandished rifles while navigating through the corridors, perpetrating this shocking act in broad daylight. According to the World Health Organization, Israel has conducted nearly 400 attacks on healthcare facilities in the Gaza Strip, including on every single one of its hospitals, leaving the majority non-functional as of February 12. This illustration, published by the WHO, details the Israeli strikes on healthcare facilities in the Gaza Strip. According to the report by the World Health Organization, at least 659 people have lost their lives and more than 840 others injured in Israeli attacks as of February 12. Nearly 100 ambulances have been targeted, with more than 50 destroyed by the Israeli missiles. As of February 12, only 11 out of 36 hospitals in Gaza are partially functioning, 5 in the north and 6 in the south. According to the World Health Organization, hospital bed capacity across all of Gaza has now been reduced from 3,500 to just 1,400. But this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the disaster seems to be much worse. Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, is one of the international organizations actively working in Gaza despite Israeli attacks. Doctors Without Borders has already lost several staff members in recent months as a result of Israeli attacks. In the most recent attack, the Israeli military deliberately targeted an MSF shelter in Gaza, killing two people and wounding several others. As an international charity organization, MSF is committed to independence, neutrality, and impartiality, as it only seeks to provide medical services to vulnerable people across the world, especially those trapped in conflicts and war zones. According to MSF, the Israeli military systematically targets health facilities in Gaza. Médecins Sans Frontières deplores a situation in which people have been left with no options to go for treatment in case of a large influx of war-wounded patients. These systematic attacks against healthcare are unacceptable and must end now so that the wounded can get the care they need. The entire health system has been rendered inoperative. As a matter of fact, the targeting of hospitals in Gaza by the Israeli military has tragically become an everyday occurrence. Just recently, a harrowing voice message was sent by a Palestinian capturing the horrifying sounds of Israeli bombing echoing from Nasser Hospital in Rafah.
About what's happening here in Nasser Hospital, there was direct bombing to the hospital. They forced people inside the hospital, including patients, relatives. Oh, ya Allah. Patients, relatives, and healthcare workers to evacuate immediately. And you can hear in the background the continuous bombing in the hospital.
This blatant act of aggression saw Israeli soldiers storming the hospital in broad daylight, a clear violation of international laws governing the protection of medical facilities and personnel during armed conflict.
Israeli soldiers and tanks continue to shoot and bomb in the nearby area, inside and outside the hospital. The tanks moving inside the hospital. We cannot look through the window.
The extent of attacks by the Israeli military leaves no doubt that the regime is deliberately and systematically targeting the medical centers in Gaza. Israel is now directly targeting medical staff in Gaza. But why is Israel destroying hospitals and deliberately targeting doctors and medical staff in Gaza?
Is that not only is Israel systematically targeting medical facilities, but they are targeting medical professionals. And Israel's objective in targeting medical professionals is to cripple the health sector by killing an entire generation of doctors, to the extent that building the hospitals after the genocide would not even suffice to restore the health sector. I mean, it's such an unspeakable thing, but this is all part of Israel's goal to make Gaza completely uninhabitable and compelling Palestinians to leave the Gaza Strip, which is one of Israel's ultimate war goals.
Such brazen attacks come amid the unequivocal support from Israel's staunch allies, including the United States and its European supporters, who have not only remained silent, but also supplied Israel with deadly weapons and ammunition to continue its genocide in Gaza.
My point is that it's horrible, and the most horrible thing about what is going on in Nasser Hospital now is that this has been going on for 4 months without no power stopping it. So I don't know. I think the Israelis, with their impunity, they just keep going because no military force or political force or international alliance of decent nations are able to stop them. The only one who can stop them is the United States, and they don't want to stop them. They continue to supply them with political support and weapons. So this madness is a result of a deliberate politics, a deliberate policy from the United States, and unfortunately also from many of the European governments.
The United Nations has repeatedly condemned Israel's attacks on civilian targets, including hospitals in Gaza. In 2023, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution that condemned Israel's attacks on hospitals and called for an independent investigation into the attacks. However, the resolution has not been implemented, as Israel enjoys impunity thanks to the unwavering support from its staunch ally, the United States, and other Western countries. The recent U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza has once again underscored the hypocrisy of those who claim to champion human rights and has highlighted the inefficacy of international organizations in addressing Israel's occupation regime. It has become evident that only through alliances among independent nations can we hope to halt such atrocities.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.